There was a time when we started, people would ask, why would I ever have AI take notes for me? I have my junior assistant or I have my intern that'll do that. Why would I ever use AI to do that? After Microsoft, I had an opportunity to go to Cambridge for grad school. And 2 weeks before I was supposed to go join at Cambridge, I said no to them and said, I'm moving and starting this company. So my parents were like, what are you doing? We raised like 160 CR, and then immediate instant push from investors and everyone is, you should go hire another 100 people, another 200 people. But we had to resist that temptation. The most accountable people, it doesn't matter where they are. And I believe that if they have that accountability and time, they should be able to work from anywhere.
Hi, welcome to a brand new episode of The Barbershop. Today, I have actually a founder who I've been wanting to meet the moment I saw his product for the first time. I was on a Zoom call internally, actually, and suddenly one of the participants opened up Fireflies. I did not know what it was. I thought Fireflies was like the name of a user. And then I realized it's a note-taking AI tool. And then once I saw it on one Zoom call, in the next 2 weeks, I saw it like on five other Zoom calls, and everyone's now using it. And I was just wondering who has built this company. And just by chance, I got in touch with the founder. And today, we are actually going to learn about what it takes to build an AI business. And I'm super excited to bring to you the founder of Fireflies.ai. Welcome, and thank you so much for giving us the time.
Of course, I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
We were just talking about the growth that you have had. 11 million users in one day, 7 million a month before that. And I'm assuming a lot of people are like me. And you guys talk about doing no marketing and zero spend and customer acquisition and so on. But it would be insane to see this kind of growth and to see users coming and sticking and kind of using your product. But tell me a little bit about Fireflies. You guys are 4 years old now, 4.5 years old.
Yeah.
How did you guys get together? And we'll come to the product separately. And what do you guys do? And just remember, this is an audience of maybe young people, mostly from India, who want to become entrepreneurs. They've heard like D2C and consumer brand is what we specialize in. AI is, you're probably the first person or second person after Adi who's come in from the AI world, and it's obviously the buzzword of the last few years. So would love for you to kind of break down the concepts of your business as well as we build this conversation up. But yeah.
Yeah, when I started Fireflies, I was about 20, 21 years old. I didn't know much about business software. I was a consumer guy as well. But it was quite a journey from where we started, and it was just me and my co-founder in a small co-working space, coffee shops, to where we are today, where we built out a team in 20 different countries. And it really started with just a handful of users, and then word of mouth is such a powerful form of marketing. And we've gotten to these 10, 11 million users that are people that have been using Fireflies and getting notes from it. So I think today the number is Fireflies has taken notes for over 16 million people. And we got to that number with no marketing spend. So it was all word of mouth and organic. Mm-hmm. And like you described at the beginning, when people see it on a meeting, they ask, what is Fireflies?
Yeah.
And then they start to get curious. Then they get the notes afterwards and they say, I need to have it.
Yeah.
So it started in a very flywheel way. Yeah.
Was the current idea of Firefly the same one you and your co-founder had when 2020, or has it evolved over a period of time?
It was definitely not an overnight success. There were seven product failures before that, iterations.
Talk about that. What did you start with and what you are at now? So a lot of people look at the final product and think that that's what you started out with, but very few people realize that sometimes direction changes are quite steep.
The thesis was always there is knowledge inside conversations, and we have so many, right? Whether it's emails, whether it's meetings, whether it's messages. And actually, the original idea started when I was at Microsoft. I would see people that would be executives, and they would have their own executive assistant. And the executive assistant would follow them around, take notes for them, write their emails for them.
Yeah.
And I was just a junior product manager at the time. So I felt, why can't I have that?
Yeah.
And what if we can give everyone their own personal assistant?
Yeah.
So it actually started from a very consumer lens. And even though Fireflies is a SaaS product today in the AI space, there's a lot of consumer elements to it. We have a free product And then we have paid products. Individuals can use it. Teams can use it. So the DNA was always like thinking from the consumer lens, but let's bring that creativity to business software, which is historically very unglamorous and boring. And the couple products that we built initially, we built a Chrome extension that as I'm talking to different people and sending emails, usually I will make promises to people saying, hey, I'll send you the presentation next week, or I will give you the slides afterwards. And anytime I make a promise to someone, it would automatically write it down as a note. And this was before ChatGPT or any of the AI.
Yeah.
Then we built a project management tool.
So the thinking behind that was that you should be true to your commitments. That was...
Yeah.
Okay.
Or like, I need to manage my time and I'm going to forget things.
Uh-huh.
So I want like an assistant working in the background that is helping me.
Yeah.
So we tried to do this over email, over Chrome extensions, mobile apps. We tried so many different things.
Yeah.
And then eventually we decided, where do we spend most of our time at work? And it happens to be meetings.
Yeah.
Especially if you're an executive, you're spending more than 60% of your time meeting people.
Yeah.
And we were talking to a lot of investors at that time. Everyone was giving different pieces of advice, but it was hard to remember everything.
Yeah.
So we said, what if we just built a tool that, first, simple, just transcribes what was said, and then maybe generate some summary or recap. And we didn't even have a dashboard at the time. It would just email me afterwards, and it would join via the phone call and then like record and transcribe everything. So that was like the starting point. And then we realized, wow, this can actually help people maintain better relationships, and it can actually help people fulfill that vision of getting them a personal system.
Yeah. And how's the, describe your organization a little bit. Like, this is very new to me, right? I don't have an understanding of the inner workings of an AI SaaS business.
Yeah.
But explain to me, like, if the product is the core, then how is sales structured? How is marketing clearly?
Yeah.
Is not much, but how do you structure sales? How do you structure operations? How do you...
Yeah.
How does this company look like when you started and today?
Fireflies today is about 100 people.
Okay.
In 20 countries, 40 cities, okay, fully distributed. And we can talk a lot about remote work, the pros and cons of it.
Yeah.
And when we started to build the team in 2019, before the pandemic, we always said we're going to be remote from day one. In fact, it was in 2018 that I came to India, and that's when I made our first, we were looking at people and hiring one of our first people here. And my roots go back to India as well. I used to come every few years for summers. I was born here, moved to the U.S. for school, did my undergraduate in the U.S. But I always have a family connection, and I have other cousins and relatives that are in startups here.
Mm.
So for me, like, it was very interesting that as a company that was pretty much bootstrapped in the first 2 years and you don't have funding, you need to build a product. And we were not... We were just out of college. I had 1 year of experience. My co-founder never even worked at a company before starting Fireflies. So organizationally, we didn't have a lot of baggage of a big company.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, we wanted to build something that was very decentralized and where people can work from wherever in the world. And I've talked to a few people here about remote work.
Yeah.
And, you know, usually management is not in favor of that.
Yeah.
And I can understand why. It's much easier to tell someone you need to be in the office by X period, X time, 10 a.m., and it's easy to monitor people. Remote work, it's much easier for someone to do the bare minimum, mm-hmm, and slide under the radar.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it makes hiring more difficult, but we had to raise the bar because the most accountable people, it doesn't matter where they are, and I believe that if they have that accountability and time, they should be able to work from anywhere.
Yeah.
So we've hired people from many different countries. And most of our company is engineering focused. We pour everything into R&D.
Okay.
And we channel everything into making the product as affordable as possible. Because the space we're in is also extremely expensive, like voice, transcription. Those areas were really expensive. Back in the day, that would be what people would spend for a 1 hour meeting is the equivalent of what you can get today for a 1 year subscription on Fireflies.
Surely.
So yeah, we've been able to reduce the cost that much over the last 5 years. And that was a game changer for us, just making it affordable. And AI is very expensive, but mm-hmm, if you can democratize it, just like in India, how internet used to be very expensive and data used to be very expensive, and then you had Reliance and the cost of that went down, I think we'll follow a similar pattern with AI.
Understood. And is the cost prohibitive at least today because of infrastructure, like the server costs and so on?
Yeah, there is a constant race between the big companies. There's OpenAI, there's Anthropic, and there is also this race to fine-tune these models, make them better so that they become more affordable. Mm-hmm. And then there's also an open source element because there's open source companies that are trying to continue to drive down costs. Yeah. So even when cloud storage first came out, it was very expensive because people were building their own data centers and managing it before they started using AWS. And with AI, the same trend is following. Before, there was a GPU chip shortage to build these models. But I always like to look at it as this AI infrastructure that's being built, it's like electricity. Mm-hmm. And the person that invented electricity probably did not make a lot of money, but the people that made the appliances, that's where all the value accrues.
Correct.
And even here, the companies that are going to build applications on top of AI are going to be able to accrue a lot of value.
Actually, like for example, even on our podcast, we use a software because we come on to, you know, we come on to like the software remotely, and then we're able to shoot a podcast. Like this is in person, but if it's remote, it we, you know, we're able to do it. And then once we export the file, then there's an automatic transcription of the entire podcast, which is quite amazing. And for me and the editing team, like the subtitles and everything becomes so easy. So I can totally imagine how the same engineering and the use case can be used across a bunch of things. So is note taking in calls like the core use case, and are you guys going to expand, or are you going to make this a lot deeper and better? Do you see growth in width or in depth or both?
We actually went against the general venture capital advice when we started, and we built a very horizontal platform.
Okay.
Because we thought it was a use case that everyone, whether you're a salesperson, a marketer, everyone that has a meeting should be able to use Fireflies to take notes for them. And afterwards, we do more things on top of it. We can generate reports for you, write follow-up emails for you. So we want to do the entire end-to-end experience with Fireflies. And now what we're realizing is that in each vertical, there's opportunity. Healthcare.
Okay.
Like doctors, the way they see patients, and if you can transcribe everything and put it into the medical system.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you are in finance and you're having these meetings with investors and you need to have that. So we felt like there is a huge market just for note-taking, but very few companies can build a horizontal product of that sort of scale.
Mm-hmm.
So there has only been a few companies in the past, like Dropbox, or you had like Zoho also built a very horizontal product. Because most companies, it's much easier to build vertical SaaS because you have one ICP, you know who you're selling to. It's similar to like direct-to-consumer.
Correct.
One SKU is much easier to start with.
Correct.
So we focused on like selling to everyone and anyone. And the reason we were able to do that, going back to the company structure, is we focused on self-service from day one. So there was no salespeople for the first 3 years of Fireflies. There was no marketing team. Even today, marketing is maybe three people.
Okay.
And they're just working on the blog and updating the website and like working on guides. Most of all of our resources went into lowering the price of the product so that people can use it. There are competitors in our market that charge almost 10 to 15 times the price we do.
Mm-hmm.
And we do everything that they do and beyond. So that to us was like something that we had to do. Also, as a global company, the SaaS, we had to build markets across the world. We started off with the English-speaking market, where Fireflies joins meetings, and then it transcribes it, generates notes for English-speaking meetings. That got us to like 50, 60 countries very quickly.
Yeah.
And then today we launched 60 new languages across the globe. And so we're in over 100 countries.
What's the second and third and fourth most used languages?
Probably Spanish, French, all the lingua franca like type languages. We also have been seeing a growth in India with Hindi.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we've been seeing Hindi being used. India, like our India market, the usage has grown almost 8x in the last year in terms of users and companies. So it's been really good. Actually, I have a very interesting story about being a global company. So we were just at our offsite in Vietnam last week, and we were up in the remote mountains, like where you don't usually see any English speakers. My teammates went into a coffee shop and they saw a Vietnamese person using Fireflies on their laptop. And they took a picture with them. We'll send you the picture after. But that was like we were struggling to find someone that can translate for us. And it's in the mountains, and there was someone using Fireflies in that. And that like blew my mind. This is the power of software.
Yeah.
In India, we talk about tier one, tier two, tier three cities. But people from anywhere, if you know how to code, you can build a tool and you can publish it to the web, and millions of people across the world can get access to that. Yeah.
That's fine. But talk a little bit about you speak about how you've reduced costs significantly compared to competition. Talk a little bit about the business model. If someone wants to build, like if someone's good at coding and wants to build a product and they see huge potential for it, how do you think about pricing? How do you think about profitability? How do you think about cost reduction, both for your consumer and for yourself? And then obviously, building a robust business. How do you think about it from a Firefly's vantage point?
Yeah. So as a SaaS product, the way we make money is by charging businesses or small teams to actually pay for a monthly subscription for the product.
Okay.
And the propensity to pay a monthly subscription means you have to build something really valuable because it's a monthly charge.
Correct.
And we had to also introduce this as like a new technology because there was no market for it. It's not like a CRM and we're making a clone of a CRM. It's a brand new technology, brand new category. And when you're building for a brand new category, how do you get people to get over that hesitation and want to actually start using it? There was a time when we started, people would ask, why would I ever have AI take notes for me? I have my junior assistant or I have my intern that'll do that. Why would I ever use AI to do that? That sounds like stupid.
Yeah.
Today, the same people say, like, I don't think I can run my company without an AI note taker like Fireflies. So that perception, when you are introducing something new to the market, you probably have to, like, that innovator's dilemma period, where when you are bringing a new product into it, the market, how do you convince people to use it? So we built our entire go-to-market around, we will deliver incredible value first. We will provide it as a free product. We will have paywalls in there. And so as you use it, as you get more value, you want more meetings, more storage, more notes, you can start paying for it. And that naturally was our marketing engine because the people that came in would spread it by word of mouth. They would talk about it. They would use it. They would see it in meetings. And then afterwards, once they see this like social FOMO, this proof, like, oh, my business partner is using it, or my colleague is using it, or this other founder is using it, that helped us build up this like momentum. And then we had to figure out how to solve for costs. Mm-hmm. Because our competitors that are in the enterprise space, they don't serve as many customers. And for them, serving the free users is seen as like a waste of money.
Okay.
Right? So they will make sure that their product can't be accessed unless you pay these huge million-dollar contracts to get access to these products, or hundreds of thousands of dollars. Whereas we said this technology should be democratized to everyone, whether it's the analyst or the C-suite executive or the board member. Everyone should be able to use it. And so for that, we had to like build our own infrastructure. We had to manage our own systems. So we had to like scale it. And also, when you get to these like levels, economies of scale, and as the technology costs go down, we end up just providing that value back to the users. So our margins are healthy as a SaaS company. But at the same time, we don't have to get into these negotiation, discounting battles. Like, you'll see the web pricing on our website. You go to many of our competitors or other products, they won't include pricing. They'll say you have to talk to us in order to purchase. Whereas we say like any person should be able to pay for it and use it. Like, we even have like students, universities that use Fireflies, even though that's not our target market. So for us, pricing should not be a point of friction. That was our belief. And the ability to sign up and use it needs to feel like a consumer product. It's like anyone can go on. Because traditionally, SaaS means that you have salespeople, you have marketing people, you sit them down, you go through like 15, 20 like different calls, and then you finally send them the contract and they sign it. Whereas we flipped it on its head and really built like a direct-to-consumer like company in the SaaS space.
I now think about it. Now, as you talk, I think about it, right? This is such a valuable thing. Like, for example, if I would... Do you guys do this for physical meetings as well?
We do. We have a mobile app that can transcribe and generate notes for an in-person meeting.
If you put,
put it right here, it'll generate notes for us.
For this podcast?
Yeah, within 5 minutes after the podcast.
And will it summarize, synthesize? Like, could it kind of tell me what are the five viral reels that Krish has spoken about, for example, on this? Like,
yeah. So we have this new capability called Ask Fred. So our AI's name is Fred, and for Fred from Fireflies. After the meeting, I can ask Fred any question about a meeting or conversation or podcast, and it will give me answers. So imagine having your best friend in school who actually pays attention to the lecture and writes everything down. And then you say, hey, let me see your notes. Or what did we talk about?
Yeah.
That's what Fred is. So I don't even have to go through the notes anymore. I don't have to go through the recording. I just ask Fred any question. And one of the things I've asked on one of my previous podcasts that I did was, what were the five most memorable sound bites or quotes from this podcast? And it will automatically generate it.
And is it quality output, or does it take time to build out?
It can do it instantly. And you can also specify, like, what are Krish's thoughts about fundraising or venture capital? What were the most memorable parts of the meeting?
And Fred will tell you the right...
Yeah. It'll not only tell you the right thing, it will make the audio clips.
Really?
Yeah. We call it sound bites. And so you can say, please make me sound bites around all the interesting parts where we talked about VCs or fundraising, and it will go and make those clips.
Wow. I'm thinking about, like, education, for example. If I go to a classroom where there's someone teaching physics, and if I'm able to put my phone, and there's no video, it's not a video thing right now.
For video conferencing calls, we also capture the video.
But in real life?
In person, it's you can upload a video recording and have it processed, but we also have the mobile app where you can drag and drop an audio file, video file, or you can record directly on our
I can record
app.
A video?
No, audio on our mobile app. Yeah.
Okay, today. Not video yet.
Not yet, yeah.
But I can imagine, like, if someone is able to put a camera in a classroom, especially for, like, in India, a lot of coaching happens in a very undemocratized way. People have tried to do this a lot, which is, kind of make content about from the best teachers available to a lot of kids, but it's still hours and hours and hours of recordings. And the issue there is that people just don't have the time to kind of go through all of it.
Yeah.
Someone was telling me the maths on this, right? Which is, for 10th grade maths, there's like 150 hours of content from the best teacher, which is like 3 hours every week for the whole year. People can't do that. And then you have like 10 other subjects. So it becomes very difficult to go through. But if something like Fireflies was to be applied to education, it becomes extremely easy.
One of the things we saw with university students, they would upload their audio files or their lectures or recordings, and then they would ask the Fireflies to generate questions. What questions could they ask me on the exam based on this content? And you're literally interacting with an AI, like a coach, like a teacher. And so this is more than just note-taking. Like, we've had marketing meetings, and we brainstorm all these cool ideas. And then I ask Fireflies, can you turn these into potential blog posts? Can you turn these into potential podcast topics? And it would do those. We've had sales calls, or when we have our product managers, we're very customer obsessed. Like, we listen to everything that customers say, like, to us, like, in terms of feedback. And we interview a lot of our customers. We talk to a lot of our customers. So a PM in our team can go to Fireflies and say, hey, take the last 20 customer calls, and then stack rank the most frequent feature requests or complaints or issues that they're having. And it gives us this unparalleled access to knowledge. So that's like the thesis, even though we failed on 5-6 different iterations, the thesis was always there is knowledge buried inside conversations. And the things we talk about as people is so, like, dense. How do you filter through that, and how do you uncover that knowledge? And we wanted to build Fireflies as a means to do that. The note taker is just the starting point.
Starting point.
Yeah.
That sounds, it's actually very exciting. But tell me, like, you were talking about the monetization. So you're saying you're able to do a monthly subscription and the cost is a lot lesser compared to before, or even compared to your competitors. But how does it stack up? Like, for example, someone like me, I've not taken this. I'm clearly going to do one now. But what does it cost me, and how does that fit into your economics?
So in the last 5 years, we've never raised pricing even once.
Okay,
so
what's the price?
We have a product that is $10 a month for users, and then that can go up to $20 or $30, depending on the level of complexity you want.
Okay.
But for a lot of users, they can pay $10 a month, and then we have both monthly and business plans.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're on the, monthly and annual plans, and if you take the annual plan, you get an additional 30-35% discount.
Okay.
So for us, cost was, like, most SaaS products today, they're like around that point. Most AI products are very expensive.
Okay.
So we've made it so that we could fit all the unit economics and still make a really good gross margin by doing that, because we don't have the marketing and sales spend.
Yeah.
So anything we make in terms of that, we put it back into our customer.
So gross margin is basically revenue minus product cost minus infra cost?
Infra cost, yes. And then maybe you have some customer support, but that's about it, yeah.
Wow.
That's why 70% of our team works on R&D. Very different.
Yeah, it's quite amazing, because we are a consumer business and we're built on marketing and we have to do that. But
yeah.
I think the ability for your product to actually get word of mouth is spectacular, especially if it's a good product, because you'll see the same user use Fireflies. And for $10 a month, I can use it in n number of meetings.
From day one, we said unlimited meetings, and then we introduced unlimited transcription. So in early on, we did unlimited recording, and then now for the paid plans, there's unlimited transcription, unlimited notes. Wow. So that's why, like, 1 year's worth of subscription of Fireflies is equivalent to what people used to pay just for 1 hour of this software.
Let's come down to, you know, how you've built this company. And you should talk about your co-founder as well, how you guys met. Especially if you've worked on projects before, I think there's a working relationship that gives comfort with, you know, within a co-founder situation. So how did you guys get together? Then how did you build the team, and what these 100 people look like from a DNA culture standpoint would be good to know.
When I started working with Sam, it was actually remote. I met him through another mutual friend, and we started working on these coding projects, hackathon projects for different universities. We would apply to some, we'd win some, we would take some of the money and then put it into like working on new projects. So that's how we knew each other. But the interesting thing is, Sam and I worked 2 years remotely before we ever met in person.
When was this? How long back?
This was back in 2016.
And you were in college?
I was at Microsoft. So I graduated and I went to Microsoft. I was a product manager there.
Okay.
So I started working when I was 20, super early. And Sam was just finishing up his fourth year of undergraduate.
Where was he?
He was at MIT.
Okay.
So, smart guy. He was actually doing aeronautical engineering, working on drones and satellites. And I took him to the dark side, as I say, and said, we need to go work on AI and B2B SaaS.
Yeah.
So it was an evolution, because he had a very much consumer, like, I want to build either consumer products. And I was of the opinion that we don't have like the funding to go do consumer, because it requires a lot of capital. So we should do something where we can start making revenue and charging customers. And that was the approach we took. So we learned a lot in that, in those initial periods, like all these pivots. But I always say that entrepreneurship is like jumping out of a plane. You don't have a parachute ready to go.
Yeah.
You have to now fix it before you land.
Yeah.
So you have to learn on the fly.
Correct.
That was for us, because for someone like Sam and I, who didn't even know what Salesforce is, where anyone that's in SaaS knows what Salesforce is or CRM is. We didn't know what that was. And we had to learn everything from scratch. And because we didn't have all these biases of how big companies worked, we were able to build like the business from a very first principles basis of how we thought it should work. So everything from being a remote first team to being able to, when we were hiring, focus on people for like raw talent and passion more than just experience. So like we optimized our team around that. And yeah, I think if we look back, we always look at every year, like at the end of the year, we have like a meeting where we sit down and say, what did we do last year that was really stupid? And what did we learn from that? If we don't have those like mistakes, that means we didn't learn enough.
Yeah.
So we always like try to like have this growth mindset. But to be honest, we were the underdogs. We were 21-year-old somethings. We go out to pitch to investors. No one is going to take you seriously. If you're like building the next Facebook or Instagram or a consumer product, they'll take you more seriously. But if you say like, hey, we never worked at a business, but we're going to build software for businesses.
Yeah.
Like no one's going to take you seriously.
And how, like, did you raise capital? What's that journey been like?
The first 2 years we pretty much bootstrapped. We got some small angel checks just to pay for food, rent. And living in San Francisco was a very expensive city at the time.
Yeah.
I had some of my savings from Microsoft. I was able to go back home and stay with my parents for a while.
Your parents are also in San Francisco?
They're in San Francisco. They're in near San Jose.
Okay.
And I would hear my mom say, like, why did you leave such a good job? When are you going to get a real job? So you have to deal with that as well.
Oh.
And I think the biggest thing for my parents was I actually, after Microsoft, I had a opportunity to go to Cambridge for grad school.
Okay.
And 2 weeks before I was supposed to go join at Cambridge, I said no to them and said, I'm moving and starting this company.
Okay.
So my parents were like, what are you doing? who would turn down? Because education was such a big thing for my family. And Sam also turned down Stanford and Harvard for grad school. So we were giving up a lot at the time. But there was just something when we were working together that summer before we decided, all right, let's do this full time. It didn't feel like work. It felt like play. And it felt like something I could wake up every day and do.
Yeah.
But the first couple years of starting the business, it was just the two of us for almost 3 years.
Wow.
From 2016 to 2019, we weren't working on the exact version of Fireflies that is today, but we were consulting. We were bootstrapped. We were trying to make a little bits of money from all these different projects. And it was only around end of 2018, 2019 that we started to hire our first engineers or first customer-facing people.
Wow.
But yeah, it's a lot of a grind. It was a big grind.
Yeah. And from 2019 till today, how have you built this team of 100 people? What are the kind, like, and you and Sam seem to be like hardcore engineering folks.
We were very product-oriented.
Yeah.
To this day, I have never done a cold call for our company. I was too shy. I was a little bit of an introvert when it comes to that, because I was like, it's a very important skill to have, to be able to do sales and to be able to do marketing. And I think my form of marketing is more authentically speaking to people. But we've done inbound from day one, meaning you come to us, we'll treat you really well, we'll take good care of you. But we're not going to go chase and like call people. Like, we just were not good at that. We tried, like Sam tried it. I tried to do it. I've never had like a successful cold email approach. So everything was like really built around this inbound funnel where you'd get people to come in and then through the word of mouth. So because we knew our limitations that we weren't natural salespeople or marketers, we said we're going to build a product to be so good that other people will talk about it and want to promote it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why we said we're not going to be really good at negotiating price at that time. I've learned a lot since then. Yeah. You have to learn to negotiate with VCs. You got to learn to negotiate with so many different people, vendors. But, you know, as someone that was starting out at that time, this is the only thing we knew was we knew how to build products.
Yeah.
So that's why we focused a lot more on very product-oriented approach. And then afterwards, we slowly started adding the other layers and then hiring other people that can also help. But I closed the first 50 to 100 customers that came to Firefly. So I had to learn sales. So you have to like learn to roll up your sleeves and do it.
Sell, yeah, absolutely. And sometimes, a lot of times, people think that, you know, selling is either A, beneath them, or especially in a B2B situation where conversions sometimes are not great, right? You have to go through a lot of rejection, especially early on. People give up. People feel it's not for them. And I think the ones who stick it out actually take their product to scale. So we actually did a whole series last year on the barbershop on why learning selling is a skill, independent whether you're an entrepreneur, whoever you are. You might be working for the government. You might be, you know, an employee in a company, whoever you are, or you might be a teacher. But learning how to sell is a crucial skill. And did you and Sam kind of codify the culture of your company? Because now you're obviously, you know, touching 11 million people a day and it's going to continue to grow. But how do you like the product orientation, customer obsession, how do you guys maintain that on a daily basis to make Fireflies like beat competition distinctively?
Yeah, we're very customer obsessed, meaning to this day, every single customer feedback survey, every reason when a customer churns, I read every feedback. I understand like what's happening with customers. There's this idea that, right, like when you have companies or even governments or anything like that, like there's this big push that you need to listen to the people. You need to go out to the people, right? If you want to be a really effective public servant, you need to go and understand the pains of people. So we've built up these funnels where everyone in the company knows what the customer is saying. Because too often, as a company gets bigger, they become distanced from the customer, the consumer. And they build in their own vacuum like this. That is what you're building and what you're presenting is very different from what customers are demanding. So I think that's the first ingredient to every person when we train them. We also have codified this culture of documentation. So there's like a doc when someone first joins Fireflies, there's a doc that I wrote, like how to work with Krish. And it talks about all of my idiosyncrasies, all the things and the way I like to handle things. My biggest pet peeve is if someone messages me on Slack and says, hey, Krish, without any other context. Like, I will not, I that gets me very upset. It's like, if you're saying, hey, Krish, tell me what you need help with, and I'll answer it. But don't just say, hey, Krish, and then I'm like, hi. And it's like, oh, just need a sec. Like, about what? So we have, like, these little pet peeves, like, where I'm very fast. I'll get back very fast.
Yeah.
But, like, we have a lot of these little things where I'm like, don't just say, hey, Krish.
That is that. And actually, everyone should do that. I think that's a great idea because working styles are, or maybe Fireflies could do that. Maybe sit through like 20 conversations with you and then figure out what's like kind of was the right way to work with you.
Fireflies also tells you how much you're talking on a meeting. So some people tend to overtalk. And so it's like a really good signal for managers. Who's not able to really, maybe someone is shy and they're not able to talk too much. Maybe I'm over dominating the competition. Maybe I'm talking too fast. It'll also tell you where the sentiment of the meeting is. So if the meeting was high sentiment, low sentiment, a lot of negative sentiment, you can quickly go to that part of the call.
It's a really interesting thing. Actually, I'd be really interested to know how many people, A, get interrupted, or B, interrupt others in meetings, and if you could see a pattern in certain teams or with certain people or certain managers.
Yeah. We've recently released these things called AI apps.
Okay.
So that will give you different insights, analytics on top of your meetings beside the notes.
Mm.
So you can have like a sales coaching app and you can have like a HR screening app. So if I'm screening a candidate and it can say, hey, these are some problem areas for this candidate based on what I've noticed.
Mm.
And I've seen people improve their own speaking skills through using these different apps on top of Fireflies because they'll use filler words like.
Uh-huh.
Even I do it from time to time, or I constantly am using some jargon or I'm rambling. Fireflies will also tell you, hey, you spoke nonstop for 15 minutes. Like, you should not do that. So there's a lot of teaching that can also
And that's
happen.
Private, right? That's only for you.
Yeah, you can have it. You can build it for yourself and have it access to you, just yourself. Yeah.
Wow. That's actually quite incredible. That is incredible. How do you see you and Sam, like, are you guys, how do you guys divide work between both of you? Who's the CEO? Or do you guys have a professional CEO? How do you guys structure that part?
We had that conversation very early, and Sam was like, we're both product-oriented. He's more engineering-oriented. You're going to be able to go raise funding. You don't mind being in front of the camera. You don't mind communicating. So it was a very quick...
As people don't say, hey, Krish.
So it was like a very like immediate decision, but what we have split it up. So I'm the CEO, Sam is the CTO, but we're involved and discuss almost all the important things. I still am very involved with engineering. I'm like architectural decisions, product launches, roadmaps. We don't have a chief product officer, so I'm still serving that hat. As well, we have a very flat organization, and so the company of our size for the number of people we're serving, we're only 100 people today.
Yeah, that's quite.
There are other companies the same size that are probably 500 to 1,000 people, and we actually really focus on keeping our company small. We actually have a rule internally that we wanna, how many people can we serve? What's the most amount of people we can serve with the smallest team possible? So whenever you meet someone, right? Even I meet family members and stuff. The first question they ask is, how big is your company?
Yeah.
How many people did you hire? Like, everyone uses that as like this success metric, and I think that's the wrong vanity metric.
And it comes from factories, right?
Yes.
The more people you have, that means the bigger your factories might be.
Yeah.
But you're right. I think when WhatsApp sold to Facebook for like $16 billion, they had 50 employees.
50 employees. Instagram had 13 employees when they sold, and they had 30 million users. YouTube had 60 employees. And the craziest one is Gmail was built by one engineer in one day, the first version of Gmail.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Paul Buchheit. He actually interviewed us, yes.
What's his name?
Paul Buchheit.
Still at Google?
He's not at Google. He was at YC. He was an investor. But I was stunned to see that. Like, one engineer in one day.
That's crazy, right?
Small teams can do incredible things. And I always ask myself, like, I think a lot about organizational structure. Even though I worked at a big organization, I wanted to learn about, like, how do people work? And Sam has this goal that his entire, like, he would make his life mission to improve communication. Fireflies' goal is to help improve communication.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest barriers to communication is in organizations.
Yeah.
And my most pressing concern as we were growing and scaling was, why is it that as an organization scales and hires more people, they become actually less productive on a per individual basis?
Yeah, slower also, yeah.
And there is this concept called Dunbar's number, meaning that a human person, after 150 connections, social connections, beyond 150 people, it's very hard for them to maintain that, like, social connectivity. And that's why companies bring in middle management and other folks to help band-aid that problem. But what ends up happening is that bureaucracy gets in the way of people to be able to do a lot of great work.
Yeah.
So my philosophy here is that small teams can do great things, and then AI can help these teams, like a 10-person team, do the work of 100 people, a 100-person team to do the work of 1,000 people. It's a very contrarian take.
I agree with you, though.
But yeah, that's we choose to. It's very tempting for any venture-backed company, right? We raised like 160 CR, and then immediate instant push from investors and everyone is, you should go hire another 100 people, another 200 people. But we had to resist that temptation.
Yeah. Yeah. I spoke to a very successful founder investor in India just a few days back. And he said that, you know, the amount of advice I got from venture on hiring fast was crazy. And he was very similar to you. He said, I was 23 when I started, raised 10 million, and then over a period of time raised half a billion, maybe a billion from SoftPax. One of those kind of guys, right? And he said, we were just told that just to go and get the most A-type people, build an A-plus team, get hundreds of people, you know, in your tech and engineering, this and that. And he said, you know what, the argument that, you know, got me sold was, whether your company becomes super successful or fails, hiring good people will never be a reason why it fails.
Yeah.
And he said, I agree to that. And then it was the worst advice I ever got. He said, this is the worst advice I got, that you just keep, because we did not know. The worst thing you could do is get a lot of good people and then not know how to organize them or to, you know, kind of put them in the right place.
I'm seeing this right now in Silicon Valley, where a lot of these AI companies are raising billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
They're hiring these world-class AI engineers from Google and other places. They're putting together these incredible teams. They're paying them millions of dollars in payroll. And they don't have a product to show for it. They have a research team, but they have nothing to really go and show the market. And what ends up happening is these companies are now getting sold off for talent to the bigger companies. So the Amazons of the world, the Microsofts of the world, the Googles of the world are buying these companies. And you ask yourself, you had so much capital and you had the best engineers in the world.
What do you
mean? And you couldn't put that to good use. So it's like very disheartening, because it's really painful for investors who put that money in. And a lot of times these people will go in and say, well, we need this talent. We need this much resources because we're going to build this from scratch.
Yeah.
We're going to do this things differently. We're not going to take off the shelf.
Yeah.
And that's where I feel like if you focus too much on research for the sake of research, you're never going to be able to get something out there. Because ChatGPT and OpenAI, they spent many years on research, but it wasn't until they've released that actual product that fundamentally changed, like, the world. But I do agree with your friend on one thing, and there's this common saying that A players hire A players, B players hire C players.
Yeah.
But what one thing that people don't know is that C players bring down the performance of A and B players down to their level.
Yeah.
So we would rather hire slowly and intentionally. I would go through 50 interviews, interview 50 candidates, and choose not to hire someone than to make a hire just to fill that role.
Yeah.
Because the regret of hiring someone and then having to let them go because it's probably my fault or not a good fit, it's very painful to say no, right?
Yeah.
To essentially tell a person that it's not working out. But we've had companies in across the board where when the interest rates were zero, they were hiring hundreds of thousands of people. And then when they were letting 20 to 30% of their staff go, they would do it over an email. They would do it over something very transactional. So it's tough,
We saw this happen with, like, in 22, right? I think where like companies like Google, for example, were letting thousands of people go despite posting good profits. And I always wondered why that was happening. But it's, I think, fundamentally because you overhired in good times. And I think while Google can absorb financial slash reputational shock, young companies can't.
Yeah.
Young companies either then either erode value or die.
The cost of a bad hire accumulates over time because you're spending 3 months onboarding them. You're giving them 3 months to test something out. And then you're doing all the coaching and spending time with them. And in the meantime, your team ends up suffering. The metrics aren't hitting.
Yeah.
And you're not hitting metrics. And if you're hiring a leadership position where it's a bad leader that you hire, that permeates down to every other person. And if they bring in 10 other people that are not on par. So I've met with a lot of Series C, a lot of Series D companies where the founder's biggest struggles is they have turnover and they need to bring in a new level of management.
Mm-hmm.
And the management is super disconnected from the what everyone is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates that like feel like I want to try to recreate as much of that close-knit. You know, when you first started, it's just like 20, 30 people in a room, like that sort of feeling. You want to, as a startup, as an early entrepreneur, you want to hold that for as long as possible. I think that's really, really important. And then after like the 150 people or something, you'll see a massive drop off because you will not be able to know who you even hired. And I try, for me, it's really tough. I was involved in the first 50 hires. After that, they would only bring me in if it was like a final round decision. But to know every person's name, it's like, it's a challenge.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And how do you guys, how are you and Sam thinking about taking this forward? Do you think that, what's your vision like for the next 5-10 years, beating competition? Do talk about a little bit about how you raise capital, who your investors.
Yeah.
How do you maintain a good relationship? Actually, let's get to that first before we move to the future part. But talk about who's backed you. Why did you choose these investors? What do you learn from them? How do you maintain that relationship?
Yeah. So to date, we've raised about 160 CR, so about 20 million in funding.
Uh-huh.
And from that, we...
Across one, like was that one round or multiple?
We did a small angel round, which was a couple $100,000. Uh-huh. Dollars. And that was literally going angel to angel to angel, friends to friends of friends. We got some really great names through the process, executives at Salesforce, Slack, Dropbox, all the well-known B2B companies. We would actually go to them for advice and they said, oh, by the way, are you raising?
Yeah.
Let me put down a small check.
Okay.
Right? Like for them, that was like $20,000, something small. And after,
still meaningful. $20,000 for an individual is meaningful.
We lived off an entire year off $25,000.
Wow.
in San Francisco, where the average rent is incredibly, very, very expensive. So after that, in 2019, we said, we built the product, we had some customers. That was the thing, right? Every time you go to investors, they say, come back when you have a product.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, you actually built a product. Come back to me when you have some traction. Oh, you have some traction. Let's talk.
Yeah.
That's how it happens when you don't have a backing and you're starting off from scratch. And I'm sure it's like the same everywhere. We ended up raising a sizable round at the time. So it was about 5 million, about, you know, 35, 40 crores at the time.
Yeah. Who was
that? Was led by Canaan Partners.
Okay.
And they had done a lot of investments in actually consumer companies and B2B SaaS companies. The investor at Canaan, we knew for almost 2 to 3 years. So they saw our 7 pivots, our 7 failures. And the thing that he told me was, yeah, you guys just don't give up.
Mm.
Like, that's probably the most important ingredient I will say for any founder is doesn't matter how smart you are. It is really about perseverance because every day you're getting punched in the stomach. You're taking a hook left and right.
Yeah.
But how are you able to get back up? And the other thing is like startups, people say, are like a marathon.
Yeah.
But it's actually like a series of sprints.
Okay.
Like you have to run.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. By the time you get to that next peak, you got to run again.
Yeah.
And so even the smartest people burn out. They get tired. And people that were raising tens of millions of dollars when we were first starting, when we were like, man, why is no one taking us seriously? Many of those companies aren't around today. So that's why, like, I think success is not permanent and then failure is not fatal. You just got to keep getting up and going. Then we raised our Series A after the pandemic, once we like things started to take off, from Khosla Ventures, so Vinod Khosla.
Oh, wonderful.
And yeah, it was a very interesting conversation meeting him, like, upfront. And our investors...
How is he? Like, I keep hearing about him and reading about him. But in India, we don't have much exposure to Vinod specifically. But obviously, he's a legend in the Valley. But what's your experience with him like?
Vinod is technology and founder first. So he's willing to bet on technology that may not be immediately successful in the short term, but you're betting on changing the world. So for him, it's like more than about, like, am I making money on this investment? Like, how is the things that I'm investing? He does a lot of deep tech investments. And so for him, like in healthcare and energy, all these areas that he's spending a lot of time, he's also the first venture investor in OpenAI. So that helped us as well.
How long back was that?
That was a few years back before Fireflies raised money.
Okay.
But Vinod was so kind, like in when we said, hey, Vinod, you know, we're building this stuff. We need to use this like LLM technology. I know OpenAI is building it. And without anything, without me even asking, he goes to Sam Altman and says, hey, you should talk to Krish.
Really?
Yes. And, like, over email. And Sam Altman responded within a few minutes. And that's the other superpower of Sam, is he can help. He can respond to people really quickly.
Oh.
So that's how our journey got started using OpenAI 2 years back. So we were able to be part of their early program and get access almost 1 year before the rest of the world got to see what ChatGPT was. So that was also a very incredible thing.
That's a huge advantage, right?
Yeah.
Like without Vinod, it probably would have taken you guys a lot longer.
We would have gotten access when everyone else would have gotten access. But because we were able to try it out much earlier, we were able to iterate on it a lot quicker and like understand the subtleties of using that technology. You know, Vinod always says this thing, which I genuinely believe in, is, you know, 90% of VCs don't add value. 70% will actually add negative value.
Yeah.
So you want to be that 10% of VCs that are really helpful.
Yeah.
And I think VCs are very important, not just from a capital perspective, but from customer introductions, all of that. But you also want to have a VC that is going to be supportive when times are tough, right? Like, you have to learn to be patient that, like, little bit longer. So we've raised money from that. We've had many investors approach us over the last 2 years. And my common thing is, hey, we're growing at break-even profitability. We're not looking to raise at this point in time, but we're open to it when the right conditions come up. So maybe we want to go spend on some more R&D or some other initiatives. And the AI fundraising market, it's crazy. There is so much FOMO right now. Like,
really?
Everyone wants to invest in AI, at least in California.
Yeah.
And I had some friendly conversations with investors a few months back. And they're saying, like, you know, for a company of your size, you need to take advantage of this wave. Figure out how you would use capital. I'm like, okay, let's play this game out. What do you think is like a right amount of capital to raise? And for their point of view, this Fireflies and the AI note taker is such a large market opportunity. And clearly when you're one of the top players in the market, they don't want us to raise anything less than 1,000 CR. And I'm shocked. I'm like, what am I going to do with like 1,000 CR? Like, what am I going to deploy to? Then the valuations get crazy. The pressure gets crazy. So that's a lot to turn down and say no to.
Yes.
But you have to be disciplined, because the moment you take that money, the clock starts.
Yeah.
And so too much of anything is also a problem.
But OpenAI wants to raise $7 trillion from what I heard.
Yeah.
Like, it's a couple of, like, 2 times India's GDP. I don't even know whether that's true. That sounds bizarre, right?
OpenAI is going to require a lot of money, potentially. Many billions, tens of billions of dollars. I don't know if it's going to be $7 trillion or $1
trillion. Really weird.
The goal for OpenAI is that, because they're an infrastructure company, AI is going to require a tremendous amount of infrastructure, energy, chips. And we're not a foundational model company. So it doesn't make sense for an application layer company to raise that much money, because there's no real need for that. But a lot of this AI value will actually accrue to the big players. So OpenAI, Google, Microsoft, Anthropic, these people will have like 70% of the value accrue to them, because everyone's going to be building on top of them.
Yeah.
And then what I said earlier is that those other 30% of companies are going to build massive unicorns, billion-dollar businesses, taking advantage of that electricity that's being built. But these companies are going to require tremendous amounts of capital. And I would actually say that foundational models are also getting cheaper to build.
Yeah.
So I actually think that India is going to have some phenomenal foundational model companies.
Yeah.
We're seeing some investment already being put in there. And especially for local languages, it will be a game changer.
I don't know whether you guys have followed this company called InVideo.
Mm-hmm.
They've been around for a while. They help users make videos through AI very quickly, editing and background and stuff like that. That company was kind of growing steadily, but the moment the AI wave took off, they kind of got access the way you guys did. It's absolutely rocketed up in the last one and a half years. So I can see a lot of these companies create a lot of value. Though deploying 1,000 crores, if you're not going to do marketing, I agree with you.
We'll be doing marketing. I think that's at a certain point, like if we want Fireflies to be a household brand. So this is actually a really interesting story is when I came to India and, you know, I'm going around talking to journalists, talking to folks. I had no idea like how much penetration Fireflies had in Indian SaaS companies.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people I talked to were like, yeah, we know we use Fireflies, right? So my team recently pulled up some stats and we found that 70% of Indian unicorns use Fireflies.
Yeah.
So three out of every five company, we have users within those companies that are using Fireflies. And, you know, there's 2,000 plus venture-backed companies here. So there's like this incredible opportunity to like raise awareness and like, so there's more work we can do.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think that's the one thing that I've learned is never say never. So like never be single-minded in terms of I will never do marketing or never do sales. I was like that about, why do we even need salespeople? But eventually big businesses, they need someone to take care of them, like account management and stuff. So it's just do it like at the right time. But yeah, there's a time and place for everything.
You're on the 1,000 crores thing, right? I think one way to think about it is how do I deploy capital and my counter starts and ends, the valuation becomes high and then I have to give returns to the person putting 1,000 crores at this obscene valuation, right? But the other way to think about it, and I would love to know what Vinod, for example, thinks about a 1,000 crore term sheet, is would you rather your competitor get the 1,000 crores or would you rather you get it?
Yeah.
And then figure it out from there, because sometimes capital is the only moat, especially in a winner-take-all kind of market.
I think Vinod or a lot of investors would agree with the idea that when you're in a high-growth business and you figured out your LTV to CAC, you need to spend money to make money.
Yeah.
Historically, we've been the opposite of that. We're like, we're not going to spend money. But there have been incredible businesses that have been able to figure out how to use advertising, how to use YouTube, and how to use SEO to be able to figure out how to deploy capital for greater returns.
Yeah.
And at that point in time, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
So I think every company hits that sweet spot where you can use that and use that to your advantage. We also want to become a multi-product company.
Yeah.
So there is a lot for us that we want to build. Today, Fireflies is just a silent AI note-taker on the call. Very soon, Fireflies is going to be a proactive assistant like Jarvis from Iron Man. So it'll be able to talk to you. You can ask it questions while the meeting is happening. And in the future, Fireflies might even just take that meeting for you on your behalf without any human intervention.
Do you think that's real? Do you think that can happen?
We were actually working on some stuff where it is very much possible. And we actually had a hackathon during our offsite, and we made our team into 8 different teams, and they had to go work on these like automated voice agents. And some of the demos I saw, I was blown away.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the AI will be able to handle everything from start to finish. So we're probably maybe 1 or 2 years away from this sort of stuff.
Does it scare you? Does this kind of stuff scare you?
About in what
way? That's the entire debate about AI, right?
Like, yeah.
Like people have always said that, you know, accepting new technologies is important because we've always been afraid of it making human beings obsolete, but it's never really happened. Human beings have found other things to do and kind of create value. But with AI, I think the debate has not been, like has been very strong for a while that, you know, this kind of en masse obsolescence, which happens very quickly, like if you suddenly replace people in meetings, then it becomes very difficult, right? So does it scare you as to how quickly this can happen and whether it's very tangible things like jobs being lost, but also, you know, kind of the larger fear around being taken over and so on? Do you think that's real?
So every journalist that has interviewed me in the past year, they ask this question.
Yeah.
And they also ask it from the point of view of the education market. What should students be studying?
Yeah.
And where should where should they be spending their time and resources? So I think the simple answer is that AI immediately won't replace a person, but a person using AI surely will replace someone that is not using AI. So we need to learn the skills of AI and implement it into our own thing. A designer that's using Midjourney or some of these AI tools will be able to do 10 different iterations of a design. A salesperson that's using AI can like do more personalized emails, more follow-ups, more outreach. So AI will enhance and augment people. And yes, there will be some percentage of mundane, repetitive tasks. Like if you are a bureaucrat, like file pusher, like that, that will be difficult. But what I think also happens is, let's say in this hypothetical world, we build AI that's going to go and take your sales call for you. You're still going to need a human to build relationships with them. Maybe the AI automates some of the beginning parts, like giving you the information that you need. But the ultimate relationship building part always requires humans, in my opinion. Mm. And a human, a salesperson, might be able to hit their quota because they're having their AI do a lot of the initial research and work and bringing the deals to them so that they can scale themselves to more accounts.
That's a good point.
But we also need education, and like the mindset needs to change where, yes, engineering is important, but there are people today without writing a single line of code can build full-on functional applications.
Really?
And AI is only going to make that easier for people. Because people equate computer science to writing code.
Yeah.
But computer science is actually a way of thinking.
Yeah.
And so it's about, if you are able to think like a computer scientist, code is just the syntax, right? You can still have great thoughts, but if you need to put it down on code.
Yeah.
AI is going to be your translator where you can tell it your thoughts and it will write that code for you. Yeah.
Wow. That's insane. I don't like, it's quite insane. It's actually beyond my intelligence to actually imagine a world where this kind of plays out fully.
Today already, 50% of code on GitHub is written by GitHub Copilot. So there's AI that's already writing a lot of the code. Yeah.
That's crazy. And is this complex code or is this like kind of more straightforward stuff?
I think there's a lot of functional problems that it can solve. There are companies I've been talking to that are going to solve end-to-end. They're building AI software engineers. Just like how we're building an AI secretary for meetings, they're building AI software engineers where they actually did a demo. And I don't know how production ready this is, but they went to a job board. Usually you have these freelance sites where you can put up jobs. And they took the problem and then they had the AI go and solve the problem, write the code and ship it. So
it worked.
Yeah, and it worked.
That's scary. How are you and Sam thinking about the future? Like you've obviously built such a sticky product, clear word of mouth, people are using it, global teams. Clearly very talent dense and efficient teams. I'm sure there's like a ton of capital that's chasing you guys. You guys are young, and that's another thing. Like, you know, founders who kind of get so much success with their first company in their early to mid-20s, for example, can actually build out so much more. Like the potential is huge. How do you and Sam think about your futures, about Firefly's future?
Yeah, starting with Firefly's, we want to build this multi-product company and empower every person in our team to feel as an owner and then be able to share in the growth of the company. So that's like, we want to take care of our customers and our team. Like that's like the first thing we do. So there's many opportunities for us to build multi-product stuff. So I talked about the app store that we launched, potentially these AI agents that we will launch.
Yeah.
And just in the meeting space, there's, I think, a tremendous amount of value we can create. We're also looking to partner with lots of different companies. So we have a lot of overlap with customers like from Zoho, from Freshworks, from Salesforce. So building tight integrations and relationships with these type of companies. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done to lay the foundation. And then on a more personal level for me, Sam and I have given like 8 years of our, basically our 20s to Fireflies. And we want to be able to create, like there's the ultimate company, as funny as it sounds, is a company where you as a founder are able to be more of an editor rather than a writer.
Yeah.
So you need to be able to go and course correct here and there versus anytime you have to say like, step aside, let me do everything from scratch. That's when you know you made the wrong hire. So we try to think about how do we constantly keep up leveling the team and raising the bar. And then on my personal front, I've been starting to do angel investing. So I don't think it's officially announced yet, but I got involved in like a very big company that just is about to announce a massive round.
Really?
Yeah. So it'll
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I put a small check in, but it'll be interesting to see. I mean, that company is going up against the likes of Google, so
really?
It will be interesting. It's something a lot of people use every day.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
I'll ask you offline what we're going to.
Yeah.
So, that's actually even for me. Like when I started doing angel investing, small checks, but the ability to learn from newer founders. And we actually we incubated two companies on this side of the office.
Yeah.
In that seating area, there's Salary Say and Moxie. Moxie is hair products for curly hair. Obviously, I'm not a user, but that was a company. And Salary Say was a SaaS company for managing payroll.
Yeah.
And they both just announced their first Series A. So, you know, for us to see, you know, younger founders building.
I love that idea. It's for even us, like we were thinking about, should we start a corporate venture arm at some point? Because there's so many people that we want to allow to build on top of our ecosystem, other developers. And there's actually many companies where they come out and say, we're going to be like Fireflies, but we will only do it for this unique use case.
Yeah.
And we go to them and we say, like, look, why don't you just build on top of our app store?
Yeah.
You don't have to deal with the infrastructure and all the pain. And so like we can invest in companies like that, help them grow and be successful on top of Firefly. So there's an angle there that we've been thinking about. But I absolutely agree. Like when you invest in other startups, you learn a lot, even if they're not in the same industry as you.
For sure.
Like what are they doing? And that's the one thing I will say about the Indian startup ecosystem. It's like pretty well knit and people know each other. And I was just amazed over the last couple of years. I've been coming to India very often, and just the perception about entrepreneurship has changed.
Yeah.
It's now glamorous, which is that can be a bad thing if people only want to do entrepreneurship for the sake of looking good.
Yeah.
It's just like if someone wants to be a content creator for the sake of being a content creator, right? Then they don't realize like it's a means to an end, and there's a lot of hard work that goes into it. But I'm glad that people realize like how difficult it is to be an entrepreneur and are supportive of that. Because in the US, there is this culture of, okay, it's okay to be an entrepreneur. It's okay to fail. And you can wear that failure with pride and then go back and if you need to go work another job. But that needs to change more. And in general, though, the world needs more startups to keep innovating and keep making sure that the big guys stay on their toes and be honest.
No, for sure. Even for example, with Moxie, right? When Nikita and Anmol incubated here, till they were 2, 3, 4 employees, they worked here. And the moment they raised capital, they left. But they were here for a year. And, you know, of course, you have access to a larger office, coffee, meeting rooms, internet, all of that stuff, right? Which for a 4-member team, you may have to work out of a garage or your home.
Yeah.
But more importantly, whenever they needed access to, let's say, one of the 5 factories in India which can make good shampoo, they just have to walk across the hall and talk to our procurement head. If they want to know how do we build a website, they have to go and talk to Varun and in the D2C team. And like information that maybe took us 3 months or 4 months to find out is across the hall. And for us, we see how quickly they're able to turn things around, how they're using newer tools, how are they staying close to consumers. So I would strongly recommend this corporate venture arm. And we invest in these companies through the Barbershop. So Barbershop, of course, does podcasts and brings in entrepreneurs like yourself. But we also have around 30 crores, between 20 or 30 crores of capital by 80 angel investors in a syndicate, which invests these companies. And then, you know, we're able to incubate them and learn from them. So I think you're right. The ecosystem in India, culturally also, which is accepting entrepreneurship as a glamorous, as I think it happens in like Bangalore and a couple of other places. But even in general, it is seen as a, you know, high quality endeavor for high talented people. Right? It's not seen as a highly risky, high failure rate kind of thing that it used to be seen as maybe 5-10 years back.
Yeah.
Not only starting your own company, but even working in a startup is people take it with pride. You know, I'm part of a rocket ship, or I'm close to this founder, I'm close to that company, and so on.
You can learn 5 years worth of knowledge working 1 year at a startup.
Absolutely.
That you would in a bigger company.
Yeah.
And when I give advice to founders in my limited capacity, I always tell them, like, it took me 3 years to make all these mistakes, do all these pivots. But what I'm telling you right now is going to save you a lot of time. Because ultimately, your biggest currency beyond money is time.
Correct.
And time is really important when you're going up against competition or a market is getting hot. So the advice and knowledge of operators, our angel investors, I made sure every single one of them was an operator that had been through it and had that experience. That is invaluable.
Absolutely. And before I let you go, Krish, I just wanted to ask you, what's behind the name Fireflies? Like, what is that?
So the actual story with Fireflies was we were working on drones in college, and we were doing drone delivery, like some food delivery and package delivery. And at drones, when they light up, looked like fireflies. So we use that name for everything.
Okay.
And then one of our customers came up with a really good origin story for the name. So I have to give the credit to the customer.
What's that?
They said that there's a famous saying that, well, I'll just be a fly on the wall. I'll be silent. I'm going to take notes. And so Fireflies is like that fly on the wall that's like taking notes. And I won't bother anyone. I'm just going to do my thing. So that was the story behind Fireflies.
Nice. Today has been like, for me, has been an education on not only AI, but just building a meaningful business, thinking about it in a robust way, thinking about culture, being product and customer first. And, I'm really grateful for your candor, your generosity when it comes to insights. And I think just the clarity of thought you have on your business, I think you'll go really far. Before I let you go, I think people who are watching, Krish, are, you know, people who are going to take their first step in entrepreneurship or are waiting for motivation. They're maybe younger, maybe in jobs and colleges and want to do it and, you know, look up to people like you who have actually done it. But any word of advice for them before we let you go?
Yeah, I think India, the next decade is India's when it comes to startups as well as SaaS. And the rate at which SaaS is growing in India, because it's not usually SaaS is not as popular or glamorous as some of these other industries. But every year, just the domestic market is spending 16,000 crores to 30,000 crores. These are small businesses, medium businesses on SaaS products.
Yeah.
So if you are a student that wants to get into this market and wants to do something other than direct to consumer, which we have a lot of them. I think SaaS is a great opportunity, and usually it requires less capital to scale up. And I think the most important thing that I tell everyone is the world is going to look very different 5 years from now.
Yeah.
AI is going to touch every country, every industry, every job, every business, every individual. And you want to be on the side of the AI where you know it and you're leveraging it. And this is probably the best time to be an entrepreneur to take advantage of these like massive swings in the market. Yeah.
Cool. So I want to make a statement or ask you a question. You're going to have to say sensey or non-sensey and explain it in a sentence or two.
Yeah.
Okay. Long team meetings are awesome. Blanket? You just believe in shorter meetings?
I schedule meetings for 15 minutes if possible. So I don't even do the 30-minute meetings. So whenever I, it's like, why does a meeting have to be 30 minutes? Why can't it be 10 minutes?
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. Yeah. It's better to start up in the US versus India today.
I think that's a tough one. There's more opportunity definitely here if you are in, if you're trying to do anything direct to consumer. Just the amount of market is massive here. So I would say that that's not, like you should be doing it.
Yeah. But maybe technology and like
AI. Technology, AI, it helps to be in San Francisco. So, yeah, there's sensey and non-sensey.
There's an ecosystem push there, like investors like Vinod and, you know, for founders like Sam Altman and so on, who kind of push you a lot? Or
Y Combinator plays a very big role in funding a lot of startups. Uh-huh. And there is, if you are trying to build a global company, this is what I say is, you can still be based in India and build a global SaaS company.
Yeah.
So I think that's the amazing thing. Indian companies are so incredibly operationally disciplined. Like to build a Swiggy or Zomato in India is far more difficult than I think is to build like Uber Eats or DoorDash in the US because just of the population and stuff. So the best companies that are going to build global, they're going to be just more disciplined and they're the most efficient companies in India. Yeah.
Awesome. You need to have studied tech formally to work in the tech industry.
I'd say so.
Yeah?
No. I think there are many people that did not work in or did not learn traditional computer science, but you need to fall in love with tech and learn tech.
Are you seeing a lot of like people from non-computer science backgrounds like arts or commerce or law coming into tech?
Airbnb founders were design students that didn't do anything related to tech. They went to like art school. So well, you're seeing that. You see the Canva, like the design tool, they were not tech founders. They studied, I think, something completely different. I think they were teachers, so very different, yeah.
Fundraising is the hardest part of building a company.
It is. I think that's not the hardest part.
No.
It's definitely the hardest part in the beginning, and if you're in a capital-intensive business. But then later, there's much harder things to do. But it becomes hard if you get the wrong investors.
I agree. I also think a lot of people say fundraising is the CEO's main job. I completely disagree with that.
Yeah.
I think that's nonsense-y also. I think fundraising is a part
That's definitely nonsense-y. Yeah.
Really, a lot of people say, hey, you should focus on fundraising. Let the company be built. I'm like, no, that's not how it's going to work.
I was given that advice as well.
Yeah, it happens a lot that you should focus on fundraising. And
I met founders who are great fundraisers, but when you're asking about what they're building or what their roadmap is, it's like, I need to go check with someone.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah.
Happens. AI is going to take away all jobs and young people should be really scared of it.
I don't think so. If that was the case, internet could have taken away a lot of jobs, right? Back in the day, call center, like when you made phone calls, you had phone operators that would switch things for you. But now it's automated. So I think new jobs will be created and roles will be elevated. But AI in itself, at least the AGI future, this artificial general intelligence, I don't think it's anywhere near. And I think the future is also a lot of little AI agents helping us be better at what we do. So it's not only going to be the big shot executive that's going to have like 10 secretaries. Every person, the common man, should be able to have AI help them. Like a 24/7 doctor that will help you in areas where you don't have access to it. You'll still need like a human doctor.
Will you? That's a big question. I always wonder whether...
Vinod has a big take on this. But
I feel like doctors and lawyers, like 99% of use cases of doctors and lawyers, medical and legal advice can be taken away by AI. That's like, including like surgical procedures.
I have a lot of doctors in the family, so I need to be careful what I say. Yeah. I genuinely think that when it comes to just pure knowledge regurgitation, AI can be really effective at that. And AI has also been proven to be very good at x-rays and diagnosis.
Yeah.
So certain AI was very good at finding certain cancers that humans were not able to do. Ultimately, AI will aid these doctors in doing a lot of great work and seeing more patients, making sure that there's not mistakes that are happening. Because in India, you're seeing a lot of patients and sometimes you may overlook something. Yeah. So AI will be very assistive in that regard. I do think there will be a place where AI will be able to help the general public learn more about being healthy, taking good care of themselves, and being able to like have a certain level of knowledge that we historically wouldn't have had.
Yeah. AI will eventually surpass human intelligence across all fields.
I think that's actually true.
Yeah?
Yes, I believe so. Wow. Yeah. There's no way to like compete with on pure raw intelligence. It's like if I ask you to do a 6-number multiplication in your head, you can't do it. The computers will do that. But it's about how do you take that intelligence and apply it to do good in the world, or how you do build businesses and do things in the world. There was actually a very interesting problem that was given to AI, and it was a hypothetical scenario. Mm-hmm. And the AI was told, your number one job is to produce a lot of pencils. That was the job. And you need to make money by selling pencils. Eventually, the AI got to a point where it said, okay, we're going to cut down all the trees. We're going to do this. And then you eventually realize there's no humans that can afford to buy pencils because there's no resources left. So pure intelligence, pure innovation without the humanity, there's nothing left, right?
So that's judgment, right? But do you think AI can come up with judgment as well over a period of time? That's a trick, right?
That's if that does happen, people will just be in relationships with AI. They don't need other humans. I think that AI is great at solving hard problems today, but judgment, if AI is left on its own, it may not be able to do the right things, at least not today, or not at least in the next 5 years or 10 years. But eventually, I can see like a 5-person company working on building a $1 billion unicorn using AI to do a lot of the work. So what AI actually will help is let everyone have the opportunity to be an entrepreneur, creator.
Yeah.
And back in the day, we had these craftsmen that made these unique antique pieces, right? And then we went into mass manufacturing, where everything, the shirt is not unique, the table is not unique. With AI, we can have every person be a creator.
Yeah.
That's what I think will be really cool.
Thank you so much, man.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.